Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to this webinar on the discussion paper on accounting for dynamic risk management, a portfolio revaluation approach to macro hedging. I'll start by introducing myself. My name is Kumar Dasgupta, and I'm one of the technical directors of the ISB, and I'm responsible for the current agenda on financial instruments. With me today are Daryl Scott, who's a board member, Mariella Eisen, and Yuji Yamashita, from the technical team. Today, Daryl and Mariella will take us through the presentation, giving us an overview of the discussion paper, and we will follow that up with question and answers. We'll try our level best to address as many of the questions as we get, time permitting. So before I hand over to Daryl, I would like to quickly take you through the housekeeping items. One, the points are on the slide, should be on your screen. You can download the slides by clicking on the button below the slides window. To ask a question, please type the question in the designated text box and click to submit. And please remember to turn off your pop-up blocker, otherwise this one might not work. And lastly, a recording of this webcast will be available on our website, and the web address is given on the slide. So with that, I would like to ask Daryl to start the presentation, giving us an overview of the discussion paper.
Thanks, Kumar. Hedging on a macro scale is something that's regarded as one of the dark arts of finance, an area where very clever people get together to do some very fundamental things that nobody really understands. Reporting on this in the financial statements has also been a little bit sketchy over time. IAS 39 is our current standard that deals with it, but 39 is very limited in its scope, and particularly quite limited in its approach. So while many are able to use it, others resort to using non-GAAP measures to portray what their activities are in this space. The ISB took on this project following an earlier decision that we would take a re-look at IAS 39 comprehensively. We call the project Dynamic Risk Management, and that's deliberate, because in part we want to move away from the label of macro hedging. The project, as the title suggests, is aimed at reflecting a process which occurs in many entities, rather than simply reflecting the hedging activity. Typically, when we think of the subject, we think of banks. This is in part because that was the way that IAS 39 was originally designed. As we prepared this discussion paper, the board realized that most of the experience we have in this space applies to interest rate risk management in banks, and we've used those experiences to illustrate how the model would work. But I'd like to repeat my earlier comment. As the title of the project suggests, we are targeting dynamic risk activities, which is a much broader scope than the interest rate management or than banks. So dynamic risk management is the process we want to report on. What is dynamic risk management? What is this thing we're reporting on? In a dynamic risk management world, the managed item, let's think about a mortgage portfolio, is an open portfolio which constantly changes over time as new loans are added and old loans are paid off. This means risk management needs to keep up. It needs to change to reflect the corresponding changes in the portfolio it is trying to manage. So dynamic risk management is a continuous process where you first identify the risk, then you analyze it, and then you mitigate it. And no sooner have you done that, then you go back and start all over again. It's slightly disconcerting, actually, that on this slide we've chosen the eternity symbol to actually talk about or to illustrate the point. But it does speak to the ongoing nature of dynamic risk management. It's also perhaps important at this stage to emphasize that identification and analysis don't necessarily mean mitigation. You could decide to leave the risk open. That's an entirely appropriate approach in a dynamic risk environment. But we'll get back to that on later slides. The board has got existing hedge management requirements out there under IAS 39 and in our newly and quite acclaimed IFRS 9 hedge accounting standard. So a fair question to actually ask is, why don't we simply use those standards to actually answer this question? In part, it's because of the significant difference between dynamic risk management and generic hedging, as we normally think about generic hedging. Think back for a moment to the previous slide. That was the mortgage That was the mortgage portfolio that kept changing and the risk mitigation that needed to change to keep up with it. Traditional hedge accounting models focus on a direct link between the thing being hedged and the thing used to hedge it, a one-to-one relationship. This is a very difficult thing to do, though, when the underlying things keep changing. So in practice today, banks often treat open portfolios as a long series of closed portfolios with very short lives, a sort of start-stop-start approach. That sort of works in practice, but it's inefficient and it can have unintended consequences. Another reason why 39 and 9 don't work, and still thinking of those mortgages from the previous slide, assume the portfolio is partially funded by deposits with a similar duration and a similar interest rate structure. Because of that, some of the interest rate risk has simply gone away. It doesn't need to be mitigated because it doesn't actually exist anymore. A dynamic risk environment understands this and would look only to the leftover risk, the risk that's left behind. But existing hedge models focus on gross positions, that one-to-one thing again. So again, a square peg in a round hole. A final point in this, many hedged items behave differently to what the contractual terms would suggest. Some of my mortgage loans might prepay. Some short-term deposits might actually hang around forever. In a risk management environment, expected behavior is often more important than contractual behavior. There is no point managing risk on a one basis on a contractual basis if experience tells you that the risk will really behave in a completely different way. But our general hedge model as it stands at the moment only deals with behavior to a limited extent. So, dynamic risk management in banks. In front of you now is quite a complicated picture explaining an even more complicated thing, how banks actually manage their interest rate risk. The pink circles in the diagram, to the right-hand side of the picture, represent the bank's liabilities. In this example, our bank has raised funds from two sources, demand deposits and time deposits. Demand deposits, as I guess the name suggests, can be contractually withdrawn immediately by the depositor. However, in practice, a big chunk of these deposits never move. They are simply rolled over every day for a long period of time. You'll often hear us referring to these as core deposits. So our bank really has three types of funding. Time deposits with a longer contractual life, demand deposits with an immediate expiry, and core deposits which legally have an immediate expiry, but in reality hang around for a period of time. And each of these different types of deposits has a different interest rate profile. Core deposits and time deposits lock in an interest rate for a period of time, while demand deposits are withdrawn and replaced with new deposits at new rates all of the time through the process. On the other side of the equation, the blue circles show the bank's lending activity. It has a mortgage loan portfolio and a corporate loan portfolio. Mortgage loans, as I guess everybody knows, are very long dated and often have a fixed or quasi-fixed rate. They commit our bank to a long-term interest rate. But mortgages can also be repaid early. So their contractual life might be 20 years, but their behavioral life is often shorter. Corporate loans are overnight loans. Their rates and amounts change on a daily basis. So how does dynamic risk management deal with this? Go back up. There we go. The first exercise is to adjust the behavior. We touched on this earlier. Risk management manages expected behavior, not contractual requirements. So the first task of the risk management function is to adapt the behaviors to the way they expect them to perform. The next thing is to net off the assets and liabilities that behave in the same way. So for example, rates on demand deposits and demand corporate loans probably move in the same direction. So you can net those risks off. They offset each other from a risk perspective. In the same way, the mortgage loans can be netted off against some time deposits if the duration of those time deposits is long enough. That's the purple box that you're looking at in the middle of the screen. After netting off exposures with the same profiles, you're left with the net interest rate risk of the organization. Now, our bank in this example, in common with many banks, probably has more fixed rate assets than fixed rate liabilities. So it's exposed if interest rates go up. To solve this, it'll need to use derivatives like interest rate swaps to balance the position. And that's the green circle on the slide. So that, in a nutshell, is how many banks dynamically manage their positions. The challenge for us in this project from the ISB's perspective is to develop an accounting model that captures these dynamic processes. And with that, I'm going to hand over to Mariella, who will explain the accounting model the ISB has explored in the recent discussion paper.
Thank you very much, Darrell. Slide 7 presents the approach explored in the discussion paper, which is referred as the portfolio revaluation approach. This approach aims to better reflect an entity's dynamic risk management activities and, of course, to help users of financial statements to understand the performance of an entity by profit source and corresponding risk. The portfolio revaluation approach also aims to reduce the operational complexity that entities encounter when trying to account for dynamic risk management. Specifically, this slide illustrates the mechanics of the portfolio revaluation approach. Firstly, when an entity is applying the portfolio revaluation approach, the entity would first identify the risk being managed that has arisen from exposures within open portfolios, and then it would revalue those exposures only for changes in the managed risk. And in the figure in this slide, the managed risk is represented by the green portion of the assets and liabilities. Risks that are not being dynamically managed, for example, credit margin, which would be represented by the Y portion of the assets and liabilities showed in the figure, would not be included in the portfolio revaluation approach. And this is a very important point because risks that are not dynamically managed would be accounted for in accordance with applicable IFRSs. And this statement is very important because it leads to the following conclusion, that the portfolio revaluation approach explored by the discussion paper is not a full fair value model. It only revalues the managed risks in those exposures, but it does not revalue any other risks in those exposures. Another question that you might have by looking at this slide is how the revaluation of the managed exposures is done. And this is done based on a present value technique. And the revaluation of those exposures would offset the effect of measuring any derivatives that are used to manage those risks at fair value. And this is precisely what slide 8 illustrates. So slide 8 illustrates what would be the effect of the portfolio revaluation approach in profit or loss. And specifically, it illustrates the net effect in profit or loss, which would consist in two items. The first item would be the revaluation of the exposures for changes in the managed risk, for example, interest rate risk. And the second item would be the remeasurement of the risk management instruments that are used to mitigate that risk. A note here is that the term risk management instruments is used in the discussion paper to refer to derivatives. The following slide aims to illustrate what are the expected improvements with the portfolio revaluation approach. And what it is expected from this approach is an enhancement in the information that entities would provide about dynamic risk management activities, because it would, in the first place, accommodate the accounting for those activities better than the current requirements. This is mainly because the portfolio revaluation approach would reduce the operational complexities that Darrell mentioned before when talking about the challenges under IAS 39 and IFRS 9, such as tracking of hedge accounting relationships and amortization of hedge adjustments. So why would the portfolio revaluation approach better reflect entities' dynamic risk management activities? In a nutshell, it is because the portfolio revaluation approach matches some of the features of dynamic risk management. For example, dynamic risk management is carried out on a net basis, as Darrell pointed out before. And the portfolio revaluation approach is aligned with this feature because it results in a revaluation of the net open risk positions arising from the managed portfolios. Another feature of dynamic risk management is that it is usually based on behavioralized cash flows rather than on the contractual lives of the exposures. And the approach explored in the discussion paper also considers behavioral factors. And as a matter of fact, we will see an example of behavioralization when applying the portfolio revaluation approach in the next slide. The portfolio revaluation approach is also expected to result in improvements because it's intended to be applicable to the management of risks arising from both financial and non-financial items when those risks are dynamically managed. And we will refer to this point later in the presentation. So as we mentioned before, this slide on behavioralization illustrates an example in which behavioral rather than contractual factors are considered when applying the portfolio revaluation approach. And the example specifically deals with core demand deposits. As Darrell mentioned before, and as you know, contractually, demand deposits have a variable interest rate and can be withdrawn at any time. However, in a banking environment, it is common for customers to maintain demand deposits for an extended period of time. And because of this customer behavior, banks often identify a part of the demand deposit portfolio that is considered to be stable, also sometimes referred as sticky. And banks treat then that portion as a fixed interest rate liability with longer maturities for the purposes of dynamic risk management. And considering this dynamic risk management practice, the discussion paper explores whether the cash flow of the exposures that are dynamically managed should be also considered on a behavioral basis. This is unfortunately not free of conceptual challenges because, as you know, for accounting purposes, deposits that are callable on demand are assumed to have zero fair value risk with regard to changes in interest rate. And as a result of this, then, those demand deposits are prevented from being designated in a hedging relationship under the current hedge accounting requirements. The scope of the application of the portfolio revaluation approach, the discussion paper discusses various alternatives for the scope. And this is a key area because the scope of application will basically determine which exposures would be subject to the portfolio revaluation approach. And as a result, the scope has significant implications for the information provided and significant implications on the operational feasibility of the approach. The discussion paper considered two scope alternatives, a scope focused on dynamic risk management and a scope focused on risk mitigation. And within this alternative, there are two approaches, the sub-portfolio approach and the proportional approach. We will discuss this scope alternative with a bit more in detail in the next few slides. So the first alternative is a focus on dynamic risk management. And under this scope alternative, the portfolio revaluation approach would be applied to all managed portfolios, regardless of the extent to which any net open risk positions of those managed portfolios have been hedged. And this is represented by the red circle in the figure, which includes all dynamically managed portfolios, regardless of whether one of those has been left unhedged. One can see, and the discussion paper describes as an advantage of this scope alternative, that the financial statements would provide a complete picture of an entity's managed net open risk positions and derivatives, and that financial statements would also provide important information on an entity's risk management activities. A disadvantage that some might also observe is that this scope alternative would revalue and hedge exposures with no offsetting effect from derivatives, and that would lead to potential volatility in profit or loss. The following slide, slide 13, illustrates the scope alternative, a focus on risk mitigation. And under this scope alternative, The portfolio revaluation approach would only be applied when the entity has undertaken risk mitigation through hedging. One can infer right away then that one of the advantages of this scope alternative is that it would prevent volatility in profit or loss arising from unhedged net open risk position. However, as well, under this scope alternative, information about the effects of the decisions not to hedge would no longer be provided. And as we mentioned before, under this scope alternative, the discussion paper considers two approaches, and this slide specifically illustrates the sub-portfolio approach. And under this approach, an entity would apply the portfolio revaluation approach only to sub-portfolios that are managed dynamically and, more importantly, for which risk mitigation through hedging has been undertaken. And this is what this diagram in slide 13 shows. The diagram of this slide assumes that only the risks that are dynamically managed arising from the sub-portfolios of mortgages and core demand deposits are being mitigated through hedging. So only those sub-portfolios would be included in the portfolio revaluation approach. A disadvantage that the discussion paper describes of this approach is that this approach might not be representative of how banks manage interest rate risk in reality, because it might be more likely that hedging decisions taken by banks will be taken on the basis of all managed portfolios and not allocated to specific sub-portfolios. And the following slide, slide 14, illustrates the second of the approaches within the scope alternative focus on risk mitigation, which is called proportional approach. And under this approach, a hedge position is determined as a proportion of the dynamically managed portfolio. And as a result of this, the portfolio revaluation approach would only be applied to that proportion to reflect the hedging activity from dynamic risk management. So, for example, if a bank identified that it has hedged 80% of its interest rate risk exposure in a managed portfolio, then the portfolio revaluation approach would only be applied to that 80% of that managed portfolio. Again, the discussion paper describes one of the disadvantages of this approach, which is that it might not be representative of how banks manage interest rate risk in reality, because banks rarely hedge a fixed proportion of a managed portfolio, and additionally, that proportion is likely to change from period to period. Because this is a key area, and it has significant implications in the exposures that would be subject to the portfolio revaluation approach, in order to gather input from constituents on this matter, the discussion paper includes questions that ask for comments on the scope alternative, and in particular, it asks about the usefulness of the information that would result from the application of the portfolio revaluation approach under each scope alternative, and it also asks about the operational feasibility of applying the approach for each scope alternative. And with these explanations, I hand over to Darrell again.
Thanks, Mariella. I mentioned earlier that although the DP focuses on interest rate risk in banks, it is not our intention that the model we are discussing should be limited only to banks or only to interest rates. I may have even understated the case. We are very interested in understanding how the model would be applied outside of the banking environment. We're actively seeking input on this so that we can advance the model in this space. The diagram on this slide is actually very similar in many ways to the diagram that you saw on slide 6. It generally reflects the same type of interaction. Something on one side, in this case sales, with a natural offset on the other side, in this case purchases, and in the middle, accumulating together, a residual or net type risk. An example of this might be an oil refinery that purchases oil, refines it, and sells petrol. The net risk in that sort of circumstance might be a currency risk, or it might be a commodity price risk, or in fact it might be both types of risks. The important thing here, though, is that the principles are the same. We're seeking to manage a dynamic risk, which has plenty of natural offset, in a way in which we likely won't cover all of the risks, but will cover some of them. We believe that the PRA, and we being the ISB in this case, believe that the PRA is applicable in these circumstances. But in the discussion paper, we only lightly touch on the topic. We discuss some of the elements and some of the thoughts that we would like constituents to think about as they work through the process of this of the model. We do ask our constituents some very specific questions. We ask you whether you agree this can be applied by non-banks and to non-interest risk, whether you think that it would result in useful reporting, and whether we need to change anything in the model in order to accommodate these other risks. So there's been a lot to digest in this presentation. Dynamic risk hedging, I mentioned at the beginning, is a dark science, and dark sciences aren't always easily understood. So this is going to be challenging at the best of times, but hopefully during the process of this presentation, we shed some light on the issues and made it a little bit clearer for you to understand. This slide has our website on it, where you can find information on the ongoing process that we're busy with. You can find a bunch of supporting information, including things like the snapshot and our latest developments as we progress through the outreach process. We've also asked you a lot of questions, both Marielle and I, during the course of the presentation. The common deadline for the discussion paper is the 17th of October, and we hope by the 17th of October you, our constituents, would have answered all of our questions and delivered on the challenges we've got, so that the next stage of the process will be a lot easier. The 17th of October is obviously an important deadline because it talks to the due process of the ISB in actually completing the project. Before I finish, though, we're going to have a go at answering some of your questions. I'm going to hand it back to Kumar, who has been working through the incoming questions, and will moderate the question and answer session.
Thanks, Darren. Okay, we have got some of the questions which have come up, and I'll try and group them together in a logical way so that we can try and address the themes that are coming out of the questions. And let me start by the questions that's coming in on the general structure. And the first question, and let me address this first note to you, Darrell, is that why a DP and not an exposure draft as we go through? And that's one of the questions that's coming in. And if you could also comment on what would be the next steps, because that, I think, logically links in to how the due process, which you have already commented on.
I think in some ways, the discussion we've had now about the challenges, the questions we're asking, in many ways illustrate why we've needed to go a DP process here. Macro hedging started out as a simple process of taking what was in IAS 39 and adapting it to our IFRS 9 thought process. But as we worked through the discussion, we came to realize very quickly that the challenges in macro hedging are a lot more significant than the challenges we have in a standard like IAS 9 and IFRS 9. 9 is very much an iteration. It's a grading up of an existing model. But for us in talking about this, we realized that macro hedging actually is a lot more comprehensive. A more comprehensive rethink was needed. And for us as the board, the easier way of doing that is to start with a discussion paper that allows us to solicit views before we start actually finalizing where we think the project will go. So the discussion paper really is about getting those views in. In terms of the next steps, I think the big thing is now, over the next couple of months, we'll be doing relatively extensive outreach, talking to people, educating people on the model in ways that this webcast, for example, does, with a view to try and make sure that the people who feed back to us give us reasoned comment based on the way that we've actually structured the discussion paper. That information will come into our process and will be used to develop an exposure draft over the next little while. Now, importantly, we haven't tied ourselves to the IFRS 9 deadline. IFRS 9 is completed and IFRS 9 will go out on its own. What we're doing with the discussion paper is now giving ourselves the opportunity and the breathing space to develop an exposure draft in the time it takes. I'm not going to try and predict how long that's going to be. I think we need to give this proper consideration, and that needs to take as long as it takes.
Okay. Since you have already touched on it, let me keep you on the things on the block as well. You said that we are not going to be tied down to the deadline for IFRS 9, and I think it links into another question which has come in, is why was the project separated from 9?
And I think I probably touched on it a little bit earlier. IFRS 9 was an evolutionary development of IAS 39. It helped us move from what was substantially a rules-based standard to much more of a principle-based standard, but the important thing is it was evolutionary. We very quickly recognized that what we needed for macro hedging was a revolutionary approach, and that just meant the timescales were completely different. It's also worth saying that things like impairment and the general hedge modeling in a model in IFRS 9 were due for fairly urgent replacement, and I think we saw the need to move those along as quickly as the process would allow, whereas, as I say, we think we can take a little bit more time on this.
Okay. Now, can I now turn to Mariella on a question that's come in, which is more on the specifics of the DP, on how does the DP deal with the needs of users? The question that we come is, how does it handle the information that users will get on dynamic risk management, and how does it improve?
Mm-hmm. Yes, the DP dedicates a whole session on presentation and disclosures, and In relation to presentation, the discussion paper includes three alternatives for the presentation of the revaluation adjustments that arise from the portfolio revaluation approach in the statement of financial position. These alternatives in the statement of financial positions are a line-by-line presentation in which the carrying amounts of the managed exposures would be adjusted to reflect the revaluation of the managed risk. Another alternative in the statement of financial position would be separate lines for aggregate adjustments to assets and liabilities. And here in this alternative, separate line items then would be used for revaluation adjustments for the revalued exposures that are assets, and a separate line item would be used for the revalued exposures that are liabilities. And finally, there is another alternative for the statement of financial position that is called single net line item, and under this alternative, the net revaluation adjustment for all of the exposures would be presented in a single line item in the statement of financial position. For the statement of comprehensive income, the discussion paper includes two alternatives, and in particular, the actual net interest income presentation presents users with relevant information about an entity's pre-dynamic risk management activities and post-dynamic risk management activities. And this is because under this alternative, actual interest revenue and actual interest expense would be presented along with an additional line which would include net interest income from risk management instruments. So it is expected that the presentation, in particular this presentation alternative in the statement of comprehensive income, which provide users with useful information about an entity's dynamic risk management activities. In addition, the discussion paper also includes disclosure topics, which deal with qualitative and quantitative disclosure requirements relating to an entity's dynamic risk management activities, processes, and policies, and also about the portfolio revaluation approach specifically.
Okay. I think if I can come in and perhaps just add something on top of that, I think it's also quite important, and again, this is something where we'd be looking for feedback from users. It's quite important for us to understand from users how they would actually use this information once they have it. Right now, the current accounting processes effectively allow an activity that is conducted, as far as we know, by most banks and perhaps by many other organizations to slip a little bit out of the spotlight, to happen in the background with very little information actually affecting the primary financial statements. This discussion brings to the front the idea of actually, as Marielle has pointed out, putting some of these things right up front and center, putting them there where everybody can see them. And what we're probably looking, or what we are looking to understand from users, is the extent to which they believe this information is useful, or the extent to which they're concerned that this information may in some ways be confusing.
Okay. Can I come back to you, Daryl? Let me start off with a more overview generic question and then drill down to the specific question that we have got here. One of the questions that is being asked is that is the this discussion paper only relevant for banks, or does it apply to other entities? And in that context, we have got another subsidiary question which has come in, is that how does it impact insurance companies, for example? And in this regard, while we are discussing this, could you also consider and touch upon the OCI alternative that's covered in the DP?
Thanks, Kumar. That's a handful. So let me start out, and I think I'll reiterate, and I mentioned it once or twice in the presentation. I think it is really important that we are not looking at trying to solve a bank problem. We're looking much broader than that. We want to try to address dynamic risk management in whatever realm dynamic risk management arises. And so we're looking to go far broader than banks. We're looking to go far broader than interest rate risks. And I think this is a point that we'll reiterate over and over and over through this outreach process, because I think it really is important. Obviously, if I say that it now applies to everybody, that means it does apply to insurance entities. If we write a generic standard, there is no reason why insurance entities would not look to apply this. At the same time, I think it's worth remembering what this seeks to address. So primary reason why we need a standard like this, or why we need a consideration like this, is to address an accounting mismatch that arises from the fact that in certain circumstances, assets and liabilities and derivatives are valued using different accounting bases. So that is the problem that we're trying to address. We're currently busy with an insurance standard. And in the insurance standard, we're very cognizant of the fact that insurers have this particular problem. So I think considering this solution as a solution to insurers' problems is probably considering in the light of existing insurance standards rather than the insurance standards that may come. I think it's incumbent on us as a board to at least consider solving the insurers' problem in the insurance standard, sorting it out at source. Because if we can resolve this at source, we will have resolved the issue. And one of the ways that we've done that already is to consider giving a choice to insurers to decide on which valuation basis they should report their liabilities. By doing that, we allow the insurers to solve the mismatch problem without potentially going through the hurdle of applying a model like the one that we've got here. I think the final point you raised was OCI, and OCI is a tricky one. The discussion paper explores the idea that OCI may be a solution to volatility that's created by using this model. And I think in the earlier presentation a phrase came up which I thought was really important, which is we are not expecting or using this model to address volatility in profit and loss. We're using it to reflect the activities of dynamic risk management. That means if profit and loss volatility is not the reason for the model, we may actually end up introducing profit and loss volatility. And Mariella covered that a little bit when she was talking about the scope and how certain of the scope ideas we're speaking about may introduce additional volatility. So one of the solutions that we've put into the discussion paper for discussion is the idea that that volatility can be taken through OCI. I think we have a lot of concerns with that, because I think we find that our model would struggle to cope with the split created by reporting in two different comprehensive income lines. But again, something that we'd be looking for feedback on.
Okay, some of them is, one is a clarificatory question, if I can just address that, which has come to us, saying that, did I hear correctly that core demand deposits is not an eligible item under the dynamic risk management since it has zero fair value risk with regard to interest rate changes? Just to clarify, when we were speaking about that, we were speaking in the context of current IAS 39 restrictions and not under the perspective of dynamic risk management. One of the key aspects of this model is behavioralization, and we address the issue of core deposits specifically in that, and we ask constituents questions on if we do allow this, what are the implications, but the model does consider this explicitly. Second is another question which comes in, is will the methodology currently applicable under IAS 39 be allowed under the new standard on dynamic risk management? First and foremost, we are pretty far away from a standard. We are at a discussion paper level. And what I would just like to mention here is that the entire concept, as Daryl mentioned, the focus is on aligning accounting with risk management as far as possible, which previously IAS 39 did not take that kind of a view. So technically speaking, whether the macro fair value hedging will
be imported into this new model? No. But I think whatever was impossible to be accommodated under 39, it'll be more than easier to do so under the new current discussion paper.
I think Kumar, maybe just to add an extra statement on that, and I agree fully with what you said. I think it's also worth saying that if we were to end up with IS 39 in our new model, I think that would suggest that we probably failed in the process we set ourselves.
Yes.
I think the other thing that I would just caution against is that in many cases, because of the limitations of 39 and the limitations of scope on 39, people have figured out workarounds. They've figured out different ways to try and achieve the same end. And I think what we'd like to do is make sure that there are no workarounds that can qualify for this model. This model needs to reflect, we want this model to reflect the actual dynamic risk management and nothing more. So it is possible that there might be some things allowed under 39 right now which we believe don't reflect dynamic risk management and therefore shouldn't be included.
Thank you, Matt. Okay, given the time, I think I'll leave it to the last question, which is, and I'll again come back to you, Darrell, is that because you touched upon it, is that the PRA is not a full fair value model, which Mariella has commented upon. So while the ISB was developing this, what are the alternatives that the ISB considered when coming to the ultimate PRA, which is in the discussion paper?
And I think, I guess, like most things, we considered almost the two extremes and ended up somewhere in the middle. The first model that we looked at was an accrual-type model. In other words, what we would do is we would take all of the financial instruments that are currently reflected in a fair value-type basis, and we would measure them on an accrual or an amortized cost basis, and we would achieve the matching of the two bases that way. That gave a fairly neat answer, but it has the fairly substantial flaw that it means that if there's any ineffectiveness, it gets lost. Effectively, this pretends that you have perfect hedges all the time. And the board felt that that was an unsustainable type of answer because it actually didn't reflect potentially the reality of what was happening. So the other side of the equation was the reverse the other way, is to say, well, perhaps we should just fair value everything. And if we fair value everything, we resolve the problem because, again, we've solved for the underlying basis differential. The concern the board had with that, though, was that if we did that, we would end up reflecting in fair value risks that were not subject to dynamic risk management. So, an example, you might be managing interest rate risk, but if you fair value an underlying mortgage portfolio, credit risk is going to be subject to fair value as well. So, in essence, you end up recognizing credit risk even if you're not hedging it. So, again, the board felt that that answer was not a faithful representation of the underlying dynamic of the dynamic risk management.
Okay, I think with that, we have come to the end of our time slot, and I would like to thank both Darrell and Mariella for their contribution and everybody for listening in. Just as a reminder, you can get the slides from our website, and in a little while, the recording of this webcast will also be available on our website for you to download if you so wish. Again, thank you for joining. Thanks, Darrell. Thanks, Mariella.
Thank you so much.